This book contains up to 4 sides per cassette and consists of 7 sides.
Side 1, Star Maker by Olaf Stapledon. There is no copyright to this book. It was first published by Methuen in 1937 and published in Penguin Books 1972. Narrated by William F. Carduff, Baltimore, Maryland. This book contains 264 pages. William Olaf Stapledon was born in 1886 and educated in Abbot's Home School, Balliol College, Oxford, and Liverpool University. After spending 18 months with a shipping office in Liverpool and Port Said, he lectured extramurally for Liverpool University in English literature and industrial history. He served in France with the Friends Ambulance Unit from 1915 to 1919. He subsequently lectured again extramurally for Liverpool University in psychology and philosophy. He died in 1950. His books include Last and First Men, 1930, A Modern Theory of Ethics, Odd John, 1936, Sirius, 1944, and A Man Divided, 1950. Contents. Preface, page 7. 1. The Earth, page 11. 1 under 1, The Starting Point, 11. 2. Earth Among the Stars, 15. Chapter 2, Interstellar Travel, page 20. Chapter 3, The Other Earth, page 31. 1, On the Other Earth, page 31. 2, A Busy World, page 36. 3, Prospects of the Race, page 50. Chapter 4, I Travel Again, page 63. Chapter 5, Worlds Innumerable, page 73. 1, The Diversity of Worlds, page 73. 2, Strange Mankinds, page 80. 3, Nautiloids, page 89. Chapter 6, Intimations of the Star Maker, page 97. Chapter 7, More Worlds, page 103. 1, A Symbiotic Race, page 103. 2, Composite Beings, page 114. 3, Plant Men and Others, page 122. Chapter 8, Concerning the Explorers, page 133. Chapter 9, The Community of Worlds, page 139. 1, Busy Utopias, page 139. 2, Intermundane Strife, page 147. 3, A Crisis in Galactic History, page 160. 4, Triumph in a Sub-Galaxy, page 163. 5, The Tragedy of the Perverts, page 169. 6, The Galactic Utopia, page 173. Chapter 10, A Vision of the Galaxy, page 178. Chapter 11, Stars and Vermin, page 188. 1, The Many Galaxies, page 188. 2, Disaster in Our Galaxy, page 190. 3, Stars, page 195. 4, Galactic Symbiosis, page 204. Chapter 12, A Stunted Cosmical Spirit, page 210. Chapter 13, The Beginning and the End, page 213. 1, Back to the Nebulae, page 213. 2, The Supreme Moment Nears, page 218. 3, The Supreme Moment and After, page 223. Chapter 14, The Myth of Creation, page 232. Chapter 15, The Maker and His Works, page 236. 1, Immature Creating, page 236. 2, Mature Creating, page 246. 3, The Ultimate Cosmos and the Eternal Spirit, page 253. Chapter 16, Epilogue, Back to Earth, page 257. A Note on Magnitude, page 263. Preface. At a moment when Europe is in danger of a catastrophe worse than that of 1914, a book like this may be condemned as a distraction from the desperately urgent defense of civilization against modern barbarism. Year by year, month by month, the plight of our fragmentary and precarious civilization becomes more serious. Fascism abroad grows more bold and ruthless in its foreign ventures, more tyrannical towards its own citizens, more barbarian in its contempt for life of the mind. Even in our own country, we have reason to fear a tendency toward militarization and the curtailment of civil liberty. Moreover, while the decades pass, no resolute step is taken to alleviate the injustice of our social order. Our outworn economic system dooms millions to frustration. In these conditions, it is difficult for writers to pursue their calling at once with courage and with balanced judgment. Some merely shrug their shoulders and withdraw from the central struggle of our age. These, with their minds closed against the world's most vital issues, inevitably produce works which not only have no depth of significance for their contemporaries, but also are subtly insincere. For these writers must consciously or unconsciously contrive to persuade themselves either that the crisis in human affairs does not exist, or that it is less important than their own work, and that it is anyhow not their business. But the crisis does exist, is of supreme importance, and concerns us all. Can anyone who is at all intelligent and informed hold the contrary without self-deception? Yet I have a lively sympathy with some of those intellectuals who declare that they have no useful contribution to make to the struggle, and therefore had better not dabble in it. I am, in fact, one of them. In our defense, I should say that, though we are inactive or ineffective as direct supporters of the cause, we do not ignore it. Indeed, it constantly, obsessively holds our attention. But we are convinced by prolonged trial and error that the most useful service open to us is indirect. For some writers, the case is different. Gallantly plunging into the struggle, they use their powers to spread urgent propaganda, or they even take up arms in the cause. If they have suitable ability, and if the particular struggle in which they serve is in fact a part of the great enterprise of defending or creating civilization, they may, of course, do valuable work. In addition, they may gain great wealth of experience and human sympathy, thereby immensely increasing their literary power. But the very urgency of their service may tend to blind them to the importance of maintaining and extending, even in this age of crisis, what may be called metaphorically the self-critical self-consciousness of the human species, or the attempt to see man's life as a whole in relation to the rest of things. This involves the will to regard all human affairs and ideals and theories with as little human prejudice as possible. Those who are in the thick of the struggle inevitably tend to become, though in a great and just cause, partisan. They nobly forego something of that detachment, that power of cold assessment, which is, after all, among the most valuable human capacities. In their case, this is perhaps as it should be, for a desperate struggle demands less of detachment than of devotion. But some who have the cause at heart must serve by striving to maintain, along with human loyalty, a more dispassionate spirit. And perhaps the attempt to see our turbulent world against a background of stars may, after all, increase, not lessen, the significance of the present human crisis. It may also strengthen our charity towards one another. In this belief, I have tried to construct an imaginative sketch of the dread but vital whole of things. I know well that it is a ludicrously inadequate and in some ways a childish sketch, even when regarded from the angle of contemporary human experience. In a calmer and a wiser age, it might well seem crazy. Yet in spite of its crudity and in spite of its remoteness, it is perhaps not wholly irrelevant. At the risk of raising thunder both on the left and on the right, I have occasionally used certain ideas and words derived from religion, and I have tried to interpret them in relation to modern needs. The valuable, though much damaged, words spiritual and worship, which have become almost as obscene to the left as the good old sexual words are to the right, are here intended to suggest an experience which the right is apt to pervert and the left to misconceive. This experience, I should say, involves detachment from all private, all social, all racial ends. Not in the sense that it leads a man to reject them, but that it makes him prize them in a new way. The spiritual life seems to be, in essence, the attempt to discover and adopt the attitude which is, in fact, appropriate to our experience as a whole, just as admiration is felt to be, in fact, appropriate towards a well-grown human being. This enterprise can lead to an increased lucidity and finer temper of consciousness, and therefore can have a great and beneficial effect on behavior. Indeed, if this supremely humanizing experience does not produce, along with a kind of piety towards fate, the resolute will to serve our waking humanity, it is a mere sham and a snare. Before closing this preface, I must express my gratitude to Professor L.C. Martin, Mr. L.H. Hires, and Mr. E.V. Ryu for much helpful and sympathetic criticism, in consequence of which I rewrote many chapters. Even now I hesitate to associate their names with such an extravagant work. Judged by the standards of the novel, it is remarkably bad. In fact, it is no novel at all. Certain ideas about artificial planets were suggested by Mr. J.D. Burnell's fascinating little book, The World, the Flesh, and the Devil. I hope he will not strongly disapprove of my treatment of them. My wife I must thank both for work on the proofs and for being herself. At the end of the book, I have included a note on magnitude, which may be helpful to readers unfamiliar with astronomy. The very sketchy timescales may amuse some. O.S. March 1937.